dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence informed our programming last year, and I'm very much looking forward to our many conversations in the course of 2020, is David Goldman. He goes by the nom de plume of Spengler in Asia Times. He is the author of How Civilizations Die and a financial maven by avocation. He's an extraordinary, multifaceted resource, and we're always appreciative for his time. David, welcome back and Happy New Year to you. Let's start with your recent piece at Asia Times entitled Trump Takes a Calculated Risk on Iran. You wrote that back on the 3rd of January, and there's a lot of water over the dam since then. Talk us through what you were saying at that time, and then we'll cover the updates to it.
Well, the liberal press tries to portray Trump as an emotional amateur who shoots from the hip and does things without thinking them through. I think that's very wrong. I think if you parse the options that the United States had available to it after the Iranian aggression in Iraq, the attack on the U.S. embassy, Trump took a very well-thought-out risk in ordering the killing of Qasem Soleimani. I think it was the best of a set of options in a very difficult situation. I think it's important to remember that our president has been handed a very weak hand to play in the region because of our obsession with nation building and our ideological fixation on majority rule. We engineered a Shiite sectarian government in Iraq, which is friendly to Iran, which puts us at a basic disadvantage. We also, as the president emphasized in a statement yesterday, gave Iran criminally under the Obama administration the wherewithal to conduct its aggressive extraterritorial campaigns. So the Iranians got the idea that they could get away with absolutely anything. I believe that the Iranians were facing some real difficulty, not just with their economy at home. Demonstrations led to the murder of 1,500 Iranian citizens by Revolutionary Guard thugs in November, but also the fact that their extraterritorial attempts to take over Syria with their Shiite mercenary army, organized by the same Soleimani, was checked by the Israelis. The Israelis conducted 3,000 aerial attacks on Iranian and related positions in the past year, according to some published estimates. So the Iranians were under a lot of pressure to bring home the victory after the November demonstration of the Revolutionary Guards, who had basically sucked the marrow out of the Iranian economy and used it for foreign adventures, had to show that they brought home some bacon, so to speak.
Let me just interrupt for a second here, if I may, David, because one of the pieces that's sort of implicit in what you've just said, but that I think also speaks to your larger point, that Donald Trump has been trying to strengthen our hand in dealing with this Islamic Republic of Iran by imposing intensive sanctions on that government. And that was part of the impetus behind some of the difficulties you've just mentioned, both domestic and foreign, no?
Absolutely. Iran is selling very little oil overseas. They're sneaking some by having it offloaded from one tanker to another on the high seas to get around sanctions. But they certainly are being hurt. And the massive expenditures by the Revolutionary Guards and their foreign adventurers, they become a political issue inside Iran, and clearly a social issue.
And to the extent that that's happening, then what the president has been doing, really, and this goes to your point, really does bespeak a strategic purpose that is thought through and not, as you were saying, the kind of erratic and mindless approach that his principally Democratic critics have been contending.
No, I think that's exactly correct. And we've done this in coordination with the Israelis, who have checked the advance of the Iranians in Syria, to some extent in Lebanon. And that boxed the IRGC into a corner of the Revolutionary Guard force, therefore went over the top, went much too far, crossed a red line attacking an American embassy, at which point Trump said, now's the time to show them the iron fist under the velvet glove. I think the assassination of Soleimani was certainly a risky thing to do, but a brilliant one, because it put the Iranians into a box. The Iranians certainly could do a lot of things to hurt us. They could fire tons of missiles at the Doha Air Force Base. They might be able to sink an American naval vessel somewhere in the Persian Gulf. We really don't know how good their cruise missiles and intermediate range missiles are, but it's at least possible. But I think they were pretty convinced that were they to do that, Trump would clobber them, would conduct devastating attacks on their economy. And as I pointed out, 20 missiles would shut down all electricity production and refining in Iran. It would put them back in the Stone Age.
Let's just bring this up to the minute, if we can. I'll be speaking a bit more with Fred Flights about this in a moment. But, of course, the Iranians did launch a number of ballistic missiles, over a dozen, I believe, into Iraq from their own soil. They, fortunately, did not, either by design or otherwise, harm Americans who were in the vicinity of the landing locations. Dave, what did you make of that attack and of the president's decision in response to it to refrain from acting with violence against the Iranian regime at this point?
I think the Iranian attack was a face-saving, limp-wristed, pathetic attempt to respond, which wasn't really a commensurate response at all. They had to do something to make themselves look like less than idiots in the eyes of their own population, but they're not fooling anybody. I think the president, who never wanted a war with the Iranians, who hoped that the vice of sanctions and the, let's say, the kinetic action to limit their extraterritorial ambitions would box them to a corner and force them to negotiate and come up with a deal which the United States and the West or the free world could live with, is the right way to go. That's the president's strategic view. There are many friends of mine who think that nothing less than regime change is going to affect that. Now, the president has not made a decision, from what he said and what I can tell, to throw massive American resources into regime change. I'm not sure we have the resources on the ground, given what the Obama administration did to our intelligence community, to affect regime change. So given the limitations he's got, we don't have a lot of assets on the ground in Iran, thanks to Obama. We've got a sectarian Shiite government allied to Iran and Iraq. Given that legacy, which the president has inherited, which is a weak hand in many respects, I think he's played it brilliantly. Now, the problem is, what is the end state that we're looking for? Do we think that this theocratic regime can change its spots and become moderate with all the pressure in the world? I'm not convinced of that at all. I think as a tactical response to box Iran in, the president has accomplished a very important objective. He's won one for the United States. He deserves credit. But I think that the longer-term strategy of what we think will happen to that region is still very unclear. As things happen, the United States still looks like it wants to leave the region, which means that China and Russia will move in, and their influence will increase.
This is a subject to which we will return with you next week. David Goldman, thank you for your time today and your encouraging words about the president's strategy and vision to this point. We'll hopefully see it bear fruit in the 2020 period and beyond. We appreciate so much your time. Keep up the good work, my friend, and among other places at Asia Times, we'll talk with you again next week. We'll talk next with my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Fred Flights, about both this problem of the Trump challenge with Iran and impeachment and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined by Fred Flights, the president and CEO of our Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional who, among many other roles in government, has most recently been the chief of staff for the Trump National Security Council. He brings, though, to it a wealth of experience, and we'll be talking about some of the insights that he has drawn from his time as an analyst focused on Iran, among other things, in the Central Intelligence Agency, member of the State Department in the George W. Bush administration, and a professional staff member of the House Intelligence Committee, a man of many skills and many parts, and we're delighted to have him with us as always. Fred Flights, Happy New Year to you. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. There is a lot to talk about with respect to Iran. We have, of course, in just the past few hours, had an attack involving a dozen or more ballistic missiles by the Iranians against bases that Americans are deployed at in Iraq. We have had the president take stock of all of that and decide that because Americans were not killed, he would confine his retaliation to further economic sanctions. I'm interested in your thoughts about where we are with respect to Iran and whether this is likely to be a turning point in our relationship with the mullahs.
Well, I have a couple of reactions. First of all, it's just amusing to see the mainstream media and liberals say that it was wrong for the president to kill a terrorist leader like Soleimani because his terrorist organization and terrorist state would respond with terrorism. I mean, this is the kind of backward thinking that got us in so much trouble during the Obama administration. It's frankly appeasement, and it is a sign of weakness that has undermined American credibility. Obviously, it's not wrong for us to strike at a terrorist who was planning more terrorist attacks and was behind these attacks on the U.S. embassy. Now, the concerning, well, among other things, I mean, a long list, killing U.S. soldiers in Iraq, probably maiming thousands more, killing thousands of Iraqis, planning terrorist attacks worldwide. This was an evil man. And I just think that the Democrats are embarrassing themselves by criticizing it. And Joe Lieberman made that point very clear in an op-ed he ran in the Wall Street Journal recently.
Do you find, Fred, knowing these guys as you do, that in addition to embarrassing themselves, that what they're doing is emboldening the Iranians? At least it's giving rise to a perception on their part that there's a division within the United States that might be exploitable?
I think that's right. Politics is supposed to end at water's edge. And this is a time when all Americans should be standing with the president when someone like this is killed. That's what Republicans did when Barack Obama killed Osama bin Laden, and there was no congressional authorization for that. The president doesn't need authorization to take out terrorist leaders who are threatening U.S. troops, and I just think that our national security is being crippled by Trump hatred, and this is a time when I just wish the Democrats would put it aside, and too few are willing to do that. But concerning these missile strikes aimed at U.S. troops, there's an interesting debate right now on what went on here because the missiles didn't hit. And the administration is claiming that they were intended to kill U.S. troops. I don't think that's the case. I have an op-ed that's coming out soon on Fox News Opinion that it appears that Iran held back its most capable missiles, and their missiles are actually very, very capable. We know this from the strike on Saudi oil fields in September. And I think the reason for that is that they were afraid to inflict U.S. fatalities because they were worried about how President Trump might respond. I think this was a show of force for domestic consumption. Now, there's also an argument maybe they were very capable missiles and they were designed not to kill Americans. Well, in either instance, I don't think that's the case. The factor here is that the president has established himself as a credible leader who will respond aggressively if Americans are killed. And given that there was advance notice, apparently, of this strike, it does lead me to believe that this was a show of force. And I'm hoping it's an opportunity to ratchet down tensions. I'm not optimistic that's going to happen, but the administration sees a possibility of that, and I'm hoping that's what happens.
Fred, I just want to ask you about something you just mentioned there I had not heard before, that there was advance notice of these missile strikes. Can you say anything more about that?
Yes. Apparently, the Iranian government informed the Iraqi government that these missile strikes were coming, knowing that the warnings would be provided to the United States.
I see. And I guess I must say that my sense of it is that whether they were less than the best missiles or whether they were missiles that were perfectly adequate, but that were targeted you know, with some offset so that they wouldn't hit those American forces. It seems to me that this is evidence of the sort of peace through strength approach that Donald Trump has embraced explicitly working. And to the extent that it creates an opportunity for a different kind of posture on Iran's part, that would be a very welcome thing indeed. I'm not making book on it, Fred. Are you, knowing what you do of these guys, and particularly their propensity, whether it was under Soleimani or otherwise, to try to have some plausible deniability as others working for or with them continue to attack targets that they want taken down?
I don't trust the Iranians. I think they'll try some cowardly way to still strike out against the United States, maybe through surrogate groups, so there's not a direct fingerprint of the Iranian government behind an attack. There were rocket attacks on the U.S. embassy in Baghdad yesterday, supposedly by militias. Now, whether the Iranian government was behind that or not, I think there's a good chance that they were. We don't know for sure. But I just think that the perception of a credible American president who's prepared to act aggressively to defend U.S. interests is very stabilizing for global security. We did not have that for Barack Obama. Everyone knew what his response would be if this kind of thing happened. Nothing. He would have sent John Kerry out to offer more concessions to the Iranians.
Fred Flights is our guest. Fred, let me switch gears. We're going to speak in a moment with Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch about the impeachment business. And you have come up on the net recently, having been much in the press for months now, talking about this whistleblower and all that he set in train with his allegations that President Trump had involved himself improperly with Ukraine and withholding of funds to help them get arms and all the rest of it. Without ever mentioning the fact that you yourself were a CIA whistleblower, you've decided to come in from the cold, I guess is the technical term for it. Tell us a little bit about it and your insights from your own experiences about what's been going on of late.
Well, I recently published a New York Post op-ed that was cleared by the CIA on this topic. I also had two attorneys and filed a serious whistleblowing complaint against the Clinton White House and against CIA management. But I signed my complaint because I think you have to take responsibilities for these things. You have to be able to answer questions, defend what you've said. And another difference is my complaint, the details still haven't been revealed. The complaint itself wasn't public for 23 years because the job of an intelligence officer is to stay out of domestic politics. And I could have embarrassed the Clinton White House with this complaint, but my purpose was to complain about wrongdoing. And I suffered severe retaliation, but I survived it and stayed with CIA for an additional 8 years. And the idea that this supposed Ukraine whistleblower was going to suffer retaliation is frankly, I don't think that would have happened. He would have survived it. But look, the bureaucracy at CIA tilts to the left. There's no way they were going to fire him or make him suffer professionally. This guy is a political hack. And the way he's acted. And also, I also spoke with the Senate Intelligence Committee staff on a bipartisan basis with my attorney. I was prepared to take questions from anyone about this complaint. The fact that this Ukraine whistleblower did not, I think, just indicates that he was promoting partisanship as an intelligence officer. And he was not a whistleblower.
It was political warfare. Let's be clear. Let me just clarify one other thing too, Fred. Your purpose, as I understand it, and you've written this in your op-ed, your purpose was to address something that you considered was a serious wrongdoing in terms of policy that, as you put it, threatened U.S. national security. And I'm going to ask the same question of Chris momentarily, but I just would appreciate your view on this, Fred. We have been told as one of the bases upon which this urgent demand for the impeachment of Donald Trump was promoted in the House of Representatives, that he had compromised national security by withholding these funds from Ukraine. You've spent your life protecting the security of the United States. I'm very proud of you for continuing to do so as president of the Center for Security Policy. But what do you make of that claim? Is there any basis that you can see for asserting that? Certainly compared to what you were worrying about back in the day when you were a whistleblower, is there any comparison there?
There's no comparison. This so-called whistleblower was complaining about a policy difference. And given that the military aid was provided to Ukraine, president didn't have to provide it at any particular time. That's his option as president. But this person seemed to think that he had more knowledge and wisdom about how to carry out U.S. national security policy than the president did. And a lot of the complaints were he was not listening to the policy community consensus. Well, look, the policy community makes recommendations to the president. They don't decide the policy. The president decides the policy. That's really what this is about.
Yeah. And Fred, one obvious relevant observation here. If it compromised U.S. national security to withhold military aid from Ukraine, Barack Obama would have been impeachable for that, for never having provided military aid, something that President Trump did before this whole imbroglio and subsequently. Fred, we have to leave it at that. Much more to talk about. I thank you for your time today and for your great leadership at the center. Keep up the good work. I know you will. And let's talk again next week. Next up, we're going to speak with Chris Farrell, as promised, from Judicial Watch about what they're finding out about the anti-Trump conspiracy and much more. Straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a delight to wish a happy new year to a good friend and very much admired colleague. He is Chris Farrell. He is the director of research and investigation at an organization that has given the importance of research and investigation a whole new meaning. It's Judicial Watch, an extraordinary resource, and it has been playing, thanks in part to Chris's good work and Tom Fitton's and Bill Marshall's and others with whom we talk, a very important, indeed, I think, pivotal role in what has been playing out with respect to revelations about misconduct in our government, notably, but not exclusively, the anti-Trump conspiracy. Chris Farrell, I'm so pleased to have you with us, not least because in addition to what you are doing today, you bring to these topics a wealth of experience, including as a counterintelligence officer in the United States Army, which I think, in addition to a lot of experience with investigations, is an extraordinary talent, much in need. And I'm, again, very happy to have you back with us, and once again say Happy New Year to you. Welcome. So, Chris, I've got so much to talk with you about. The anti-Trump conspiracy is, of course, a source of continuing full employment for Judicial Watch. Give us the latest against the backdrop of what we're now witnessing playing out on Capitol Hill. Democratic senators are defecting from the Nancy Pelosi gambit that they won't transfer the articles of impeachment that were rushed through the House on the grounds that this is such an urgent thing to stop Donald Trump, and now it's not so urgent, 22 days on down, 23, I guess, now. But where are we, as you see it, Chris, in terms of this whole effort to impeach the president using the pretexts that are offered by the House Intelligence Committee and Judiciary Committee?
Well, I think the key word that you just uttered is pretext. This has nothing to do with a legitimate impeachment process for any purported high crime or misdemeanor of the president, because there is none. And, you know, look, the House under Pelosi's leadership, with, you know, Schiff and Nadler throwing logs on the fire, built a scenario that, you know, talked about, you know, the urgent need because the Constitution, the Republic, was in danger. And, you know, there's a lot of hysterical language and all sorts of drama about this, you know, compelling, urgent effort to stop the president.
One of the arguments was that he has compromised the national security of the United States.
It's preposterous. In fact, the evidence actually accrues to the opposite, that he was actually carefully guarding and being watchful concerning our national security. So, look, they overplayed their hand in a gross, really, you know, disgusting manner. They got what they wanted on a party line vote. In fact, you know, the actual bipartisan vote was against impeachment because they had some defectors.
Is it actually impeachment? One of their own witnesses said it's not if they don't tender the articles of impeachment to the Senate. Do you have an informed view on that subject?
Well, I mean, I guess technically it is because they had a vote on it and they got the votes they needed and they are articles of impeachment. Now, that act in and of itself as a snapshot, you know, is valid. Now, I think it debases the legitimacy of the act, you know, the stall tactic, the little Mickey Mouse games that Pelosi's playing and her refusal to, I mean, you can take the act, but then simultaneously diminish or actually just eliminate the validity or the credibility of it by inaction.
So as you look at the actual facts of what's been going on here, Chris, and nobody has done a better job, certainly outside of government and arguably inside as well, than Judicial Watch, what's the real story here about the evidence that is now available through your own work, of course, that of the IG and the Justice Department, the Mueller investigation, and so on? Is there an anti-Trump conspiracy? Point one. And if so, have the laws of the United States been violated by the co-conspirators in trying to take out a candidate, a duly elected president-elect, and subsequently the president of the United States himself?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. I mean, it's irrefutable, and we have documentary evidence of it, whether it's the text and emails of Strzok and Page, whether it's the other cast of characters. You know, you have Comey meeting in the Oval Office with Obama. They're chuckling about him having to go up and do this pretext briefing, which was actually a counterintelligence investigative act on the part of Comey to go up and supposedly brief the president-elect while he's actually sort of looking for evidence or looking for comments, reactions, clues that he's been running down to his vehicle to document in memos that he then leaks to the press. I mean, this, frankly, this is a bad novel. If someone wrote this and, you know, put it in novel form, you know, you're at the beach reading a summer thriller, you'd leave it in the sand. I mean, but sadly, this is reality. This happened.
And Chris, one of the things that, again, Judicial Watch's Freedom of Information Act inquiries and lawsuits when the government agencies in question don't respond has, I think, documented exhaustively is the direct involvement of many of these players and sort of the Obama administration writ large with the dossier that this fellow Steele generated that Hillary Clinton's Oppo research paid for and so on. Give us the latest on what you have found in that regard.
Well, I think, you know, people are focused on the FBI and DOJ for all the obvious reasons that, you know, you just sort of recapped. But what people I don't think are terribly up to speed on is how frantic the efforts were in the State Department to spread around the Steele dossier and also force out as much sort of classified material they could around the Steele dossier to bolster its credibility. And so we've just uncovered, I think it's 11 or 13 pages of material. And again, this is through litigation. We had to sue to get this, where very senior actors in the State Department are using their personal email to bolster or to spread around Steele dossier and other sort of tangential material, trying to bolster it and say, see, the Russians are doing this or that. It's baseless, but they're just trying to paper it up. And they're doing it using their personal emails, even when they acknowledge, oh yeah, this should be on the high side, meaning the classified system at State Department. But they're in such a frantic race to dump out as much information as they could pre the inauguration of President Trump that they just want to muddy the waters so desperately and make it look bad that we have their private emails.
Chris, I just want to ask you about one thing. Diana West, who I know you're a big fan of, as am I, has been focusing intensively on what she considers to be a central element of this whole anti-Trump conspiracy that has largely gone, well, if not unnoted, certainly gotten less attention than it seems to me and her that it deserves. And that is the whole premise that the Russians were involved in trying to aid and abet the Trump candidacy by virtue of having hacked into the Democratic National Committee's servers, something that has been attested to by an organization that seems to be rather dubious, namely CrowdStrike. This was something, of course, that President Trump was asking the Ukrainian Prime Minister for help with. Give us just your quick professional judgment of what's gone on in that regard.
Yeah, so CrowdStrike is a technical services sort of information security firm founded by retired FBI guys who are, you know, cyber investigation types. And, you know, when the DNC server hack issue came up, rather than make the criminal complaint and ask the FBI to come in and examine what had happened to them, and you would think that, you know, a major national political party would want law enforcement to look at the problem and evaluate it. Instead, they engaged the services of CrowdStrike, which are all retired, not all, but founded by retired FBI guys, to do the analysis. I mean, essentially, and the FBI stood by with their hands in their pockets and said, okay, fine, go ahead, let them do it. They outsourced, essentially, a legitimate criminal investigation with national security implications to their buddies who retired X number of months or years ago. Well, that's not evidence. You know, having a private consulting firm evaluate something, generate a report with redactions that the FBI then sort of adopts and accepts as being legitimate.
Not just legitimate, but as obviating the need for them to do any forensic drill down of their own. I mean, that's the thing that's amazing. As well as, in addition to these FBI guys, you got a Russian expat by the name of Dmitry Alperovich, whose role in the Obama administration as a contractor, I think, also warrants close scrutiny. And yet, very little of this seems to have gotten that kind of attention. Am I missing something?
I cannot think of any other serious criminal investigation with respect to whether it's hacking or fraud or any of those sorts of crimes, sort of a white-collar technical crime, right? Not a bank robbery, not a murder, but something, you know, in the realm of information systems. I cannot think of another instance wherein the FBI waived their legitimate law enforcement authority and outsourced it to their retired buddies and then shrugged and said, okay, good enough.
It stinks to high heavens, I think. But Chris, we are out of time. We're going to have to come back to this. And I've got so much more to talk with you about, including the great work that you guys have been doing on voter fraud. These are topics for another day, though. Come back to us again soon, if you would. We appreciate so much all the help you gave us in 2019 and look forward to collaborating with you and your colleagues at Judicial Watch actively in 2020 as well. Godspeed, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about China and Hong Kong and us and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's with great pleasure that I say Happy New Year to a friend and tremendously valued contributor to this program, Gordon Chang. We haven't spoken with him for some time due to the extended holidays, but have been anxious to catch up with him because despite the preoccupation of the moment in the Middle East, and specifically Iran, there are some things going on elsewhere in the world, including much in his portfolio, which is, of course, Asia. Gordon is the author of three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. He writes brilliantly and appears frequently in various media outlets, including, of course, Fox News, The National Interest, and so on. And you can follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, a happy new year indeed. Welcome. It's always better to have you with us. Let me ask you, speaking of losing South Korea, Gordon, North Korea is a part of the Iranian enterprise that has not gotten as much attention as have some of the areas of the world closer to Tehran. Tell us a little bit about what we know of Kim Jong-un's role and relationship with the former head of the Quds Force in Iran, Qasem Soleimani.
North Korea's links with Soleimani are deep. North Korea receives an estimated $2.5 to $3 billion a year from Iran, much of it from Soleimani. And that's significant to the North because that's about 10% of the North's gross domestic product. There are a number of different areas of cooperation. One that doesn't get very much in the way of attention is that the North Koreans have been training Hamas, Hezbollah, and these are the proxy armies that Soleimani was responsible for. Those rockets that descended on Erbil, those are North Korean in origin. And so there are just so many linkages here. And they're so important to both sides.
I think it's also the case, if I'm not mistaken, Gordon, that North Korean underground tunneling technology has also been brought to bear on behalf of Hezbollah and its efforts to develop facilities in which to house missiles prepared for attacking Israel. And Hamas tunnels to get under the Gaza Strip frontier and the like. So these ties are very real and very consequential. I think there's no question about it.
The tunneling is also to bury Iran's nuclear weapons facilities underground. So there's another tunneling link there.
One other point on North Korea. Gordon, you've written this book about what's happening to South Korea under the presidency of Moon Jae-in, who seems to be really a fellow traveler with his North Korean counterpart more and more brazenly. This is evidenced, among other things, in the treatment of some of the people who've managed to get themselves out of North Korea to flee to other parts of Asia, most recently in Vietnam. And apparently there have been reports that some American diplomats actually intervened to help get them out of Vietnam, 13 of them, before they were to be sent back to the North to a very unhappy fate, needless to say. And there was absolutely no help from South Korea, which, as I understand it, Gordon, has a constitutional responsibility to treat those people as citizens and welcome them in.
Yes, it does. And that is part of the Constitution of the Republic of Korea. Even worse than this incident in Vietnam is one of several months ago where the South, within a couple days, returned to a North Korean fisherman who wanted asylum in the South. They were returned without any substantial investigation, against their wishes, and clearly to a certain death in the North. So this is another awful incident that we have seen. In general, South Korea has made life very difficult for North Korean defectors who have indeed made it to the South. So this is Moon Jae-in helping the North Koreans.
And Gordon, let me turn to China. There have been reports of arrests of Chinese students photographing American military facilities. By some estimates, there have been something on the order of 300,000 of these students in the United States. Now, obviously, not all of them are engaged in what seems to be espionage, but some presumably are, especially in light of the laws on the books in China. Tell us about that and what it means for our country in terms of a serious counterintelligence problem.
Well, China's national intelligence law, enacted in 2017, requires every Chinese national or every Chinese entity to spy if a request has been made. And so this puts Chinese nationals under a compulsion to spy against the United States. And there have, as we all know, troubling incidents of Chinese nationals, including a series of incidents involving Chinese students involved in spying in the United States.
Gordon, the fact that this is such a large problem with Chinese nationals, some of whom are students, some of whom, you know, may be here on various work-related visas and the like, is, as I say, a serious counterintelligence problem. It's all the more striking because just recently, as I understand it, the Chinese government has said there will be no foreign nationals involved in or materials used in Chinese education. Have I got that right in teaching and training applications particularly?
You got that right. China's Ministry of Education has issued another edict banning the use of foreign materials. and requiring all materials to be used in the secondary schools to reflect Marxist thinking and Chinese culture. This is a closing of the Chinese mind. This occurred, of course, in the Maoist years in the 1950s. It also occurred during the Ming Dynasty. And every time that this happens, it results in disaster for China. At this time, I hope the disaster does not affect us. But clearly, that could very well be the case.
Well, particularly if what is being therefore taught to Chinese students is a sort of Maoist or Xi Jinping thought, for that matter, that is very aggressive and hostile to us. Speaking of Xi, Gordon, there was a development this week involving a new senior official representing him in Hong Kong. What do we know about this fellow, and what do you make of his arrival on the scene at this particular moment?
This is you're referring to a guy named Liu, L-U-O. He was brought out of semi-retirement to head the liaison office, which is the most important, which basically represents Beijing in Hong Kong. The former head was turfed out. The new guy knows nothing about Hong Kong. There's a lot of speculation about whether this is a softening of Xi Jinping's policy or a hardening. I tend to think it's a hardening, but for a number of reasons, considering the language that Beijing has been issuing recently. Xi Jinping must be very upset. He thought that China's friends would win in the November district council elections. They were annihilated as they were lost across the board. Beijing is obviously very upset about the advice that they've been getting from the liaison office. But Frank, this is the result of Xi Jinping demanding good news and officials providing good news to him. And this shows the weakness of the communist system.
One of the things that I was struck by in a report, I think the New York Times had, about the arrival of this fellow, Liu Huiwen, in Hong Kong was a comment that he had made about his role in other trouble spots that have been thorns in Xi's side, as having been the man who was responsible for cleaning up what he called the, quote, political ecology, unquote. And if, in fact, that's the kind of guy that they've sent to Hong Kong at this particular moment, I just wonder, Gordon, whether you would credit the possibility that since he seems to have been deployed there rather hastily, perhaps it may have had something to do with not only the larger frustrations that Xi obviously has about Hong Kong, but also that is an opportunity to perhaps exercise more, shall we say, political, ecological control in Hong Kong while the West, the United States specifically, is quite distracted in the Middle East.
Yeah, I agree with that, because one of the reasons why I think this is not a softening of Beijing's position is because at the same time, we have heard Beijing demand Article 23 legislation in Hong Kong. Article 23 is basically national security rules. Beijing has been trying to implement these since 2003, but there's been resistance across Hong Kong society since then. And so I assume that the changes at the liaison office basically are in connection with an attempt to impose even more draconian legislation. Got to remember that all of these protests started by Beijing trying to implement an extradition law. So putting in another law just is going to be really contentious.
Or simply just starting to enforce it. Whether they put it in some other judicial or legal process remains to be seen. But enforcing it is the key problem, is it not? Gordon, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for joining us, as you did so handsomely in 2019 and in the years preceding it. And we look forward to our frequent and deep weekly visits with you in 2020. Happy New Year again to you, and let's hope it is one. Happy New Year to everybody else. We look forward to talking with you again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.